It's Thursday, November 26, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, tensions between Turkey and Russia continue to mount following Ankara's downing of a Russian warplane. We talk with an analyst.
You don't underestimate Putin and his ability to surprise you.
Holiday shoppers prepare for Black Friday sales, and American dancer and choreographer Twyla Tharp celebrates 50 years of performing with a new tour. It's all ahead. As French President François Hollande continued his global diplomatic effort to forge an alliance against the Islamic State group with a stop in Moscow Thursday, tensions between Russia and Turkey over the downing of a Russian warplane remain high. Russia has announced increased inspections of Turkish food imports. Wednesday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov told a news conference in Moscow Russia does not intend to wage war on Turkey, but said Tuesday's downing of the Su-24 bomber by Turkish jet fighters, an incident that took the life of a Russian crewman, looked very much like a pre-planned operation and promised a reassessment of bilateral relations. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called it a purely defensive move, not designed to escalate matters. Moscow has announced plans to deploy an air defense missile system in northwestern Syria to protect its aircraft. Ambassador James Jeffrey, who was posted to Ankara and is now with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it was a calculated move by Russian President Vladimir Putin.
It's probably the least Putin could do, and it represents not a good thing because it will threaten the Israelis, and the thing has a range of 155 miles, potentially also some of our aircraft if they were foolish enough to shoot at us. It's essentially a defensive step, and it's better than bombing a Turkish airfield.
Was that a possibility in your view?
Here's the thing. We have learned since 1999, with Putin's having a major role in Russian battalions showing up in Kosovo after we had defeated the Serbs, that you don't underestimate Putin and his ability to surprise you. And he's a guy who basically takes risks all the time with the assumption, which he has been proven correct again and again and again, with all of the NATO allies and all kinds of overflights of NATO territory, all sorts of provocations, his submarines in national waters, what he's done in Crimea, what he did in the Ukraine. And he's done this repeatedly with the Turks, particularly back in October. He not only penetrated Turkish airspace, but they locked on Turkish aircraft with their fire control radars. And they've been warned repeatedly by the Turks on this, and the Turks also warned them about bombing the Turkmen right along the border. I think he was surprised by what Erdogan did.
Is this going to suck the NATO alliance and Russia into some sort of confrontation?
I don't see how. If Russia takes military action against Turkey, yes, obviously, but Russia hasn't taken military action against Turkey. And NATO already has surface-to-air missiles in southern Turkey. We just withdrew them, but they can go back in. We have a relatively large contingent of aircraft at Incirlik and elsewhere in southern Turkey. And the Turks have a fleet of 200-plus F-16s. To put that in context, Putin has, well, he had 30 aircraft, roughly. Now he's got 29.
Ambassador Jeffrey says Russia has little leverage with Turkey given its membership in NATO and control of key shipping lanes Russia uses. However, the University of San Francisco, Stephen Zunes, was surprised at Turkey's military action.
This was a surprisingly provocative act by Turkey given their economic dependence on Russia. I was actually on the Turkish coast just a few months ago, and I was struck by the large number of Russian tourists, including Russian business people, and so they will probably be feeling a hit as a result of this. I mean, when an airplane crosses international boundary into a country's airspace, they do have the legal right to shoot them down. But given that this infraction lasted only 17 seconds and they were not bombing within Turkey, it does raise questions about why they would go to the extent of defending their airspace by actually shooting down a plane.
Neither side is backing down. Turkey's President Erdogan remained rather defiant that Turkey did the right thing.
There's a lot more at stake here than simply an infraction across a border. The bombing raids in that part of Syria near the Turkish border have not been directed at ISIS. ISIS does not have any presence in that province. They have been fighting fighters from al-Nusra, which Turkey has been quietly supporting. But they're also, and this is an important piece, Turkmen militia. These are an ethnic minority that are closely related to Turks themselves, who have been getting quite a bit of support from the Erdogan government. Indeed, these were probably the targets of the Russian airstrikes, which is why Turkey may have felt a particular desire to take down that Russian plane.
And Stephen Zun says the longer these tensions between the two major players in Syria's future persist, the longer the Islamic State will continue to operate inside both Syria and Iraq. Well, for more on Russia's military moves in Syria and how they're being reported on social media, we're joined now in the studio by Michael Lippin. Michael, what's the latest?
Hi, Sarah. Well, the Russian state-controlled news agency Sputnik has been busy tweeting about Russia's deployment of its S-400 air defense missile system in Syria. It's been tweeting the hashtag S-400, that's S-400, and linking to articles with headlines like, Syria is getting the best air defense missile system ever. Now, to be fair, if you look in that article, that line about the S-400 system being so great comes from a security analyst whom Sputnik identifies as U.S. Navy veteran Mark Sloboda. But, you know, Sputnik is not shy about promoting the Russian government's verbal attacks on Turkey. Russia, of course, is angry at Turkey for shooting down a Russian warplane earlier this week in disputed circumstances along the Syrian-Turkish border. Russian President Putin even accused Turkey of stabbing Russia in the back over the shootdown. And the Sputnik news agency has been promoting the hashtag backstabbed on Twitter. The Topsy Analytics website shows that backstabbed has been used 2,000 times in the past day. And if you search for that hashtag on Twitter, you can even find a cartoon of Putin being stabbed in the back by the white crescent of the Turkish flag. Now, on a lighter note, it's the Thanksgiving holiday here in the U.S., and when you look at the top trending items on Twitter worldwide and in the U.S., can you guess what the number one item is?
Let's see. Turkey, football, pumpkin pie. I don't know, just some of them.
It's actually much simpler than that. It's Happy Thanksgiving.
Oh.
So Happy Thanksgiving, Sarah.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Michael. That's Michael Lippin, and this is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists in California have found that the largest moon of Mars, Phobos, is slowly inching closer toward the red planet. They predict that once the gravity of Mars finally overpowers the moon in about 20 to 40 million years, the moon will probably be shredded to bits. The scientists from the University of California, Berkeley, explain that since Phobos is in such fragile condition, the closer it gets to the red planet, it will begin to break up instead of crashing into Mars intact. While some of the moon's largest remains will probably smash into Mars, most of the smaller bits and pieces are expected to spread out above the planet, where they will circle it like the rings of Saturn. After millions of years of orbiting the planet, the researchers say that Phobos remains will eventually fall to the surface of Mars, much like our meteor showers here on Earth. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at Twyla Tharp's dance career. Pope Francis, on his second day in Africa Thursday, told an interfaith audience of Christian and Muslim leaders they must engage in dialogue to guard against radicalization and acts of violence in the name of God. He said such discussions are essential and pointed to recent Islamist attacks in Kenya, including last April's assault on Garissa University by al-Shabaab militants that left 150 people dead and the 2013 Islamist attack on Nairobi's Westgate Mall that took 67 lives. It was one of the themes mentioned in the Pope's welcoming remarks at the presidential residence State House soon after his arrival Wednesday in the Kenyan capital.
All men and women of goodwill are called to work for reconciliation and peace, forgiveness and healing. in the work of building a sound democratic order, threatening cohesion and integration, tolerance and respect for others, the pursuit of the common good must be a primary goal. Experience shows that violence, conflict, and terrorism feed on fear, mistrust, and despair born of poverty and frustration.
In Thursday's remarks, the Pope said the God whom we seek to serve is a God of peace, and he appealed to both Christians and Muslims to live in peace, harmony, and mutual respect. The Pope has also emphasized his concern over poverty and its link to violence, official corruption, as well as preserving the environment. The Reverend Brian Lucas is General Secretary of the Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, the Pope's landmark visit to Kenya, Uganda, and Central African Republic underscores the shifting center of gravity for the global Catholic Church, with the African Church expected to reach 500 million people by 2050.
The Pope has shown already a predilection for going to places other than places that normally capture the attention of the Church. For a long time, the Catholic Church has been very Western culturally centred, Euro-centred. He made, of course, a very significant visit to the United States, which made its own statement. But this visit to Africa, to the Southern Hemisphere, is a visit to the place in the world where the Church, of course, is growing the fastest. There are many countries he could have visited, and perhaps the three that are chosen are opportunities for him to meet certainly a significant Christian and significant Catholic populations in those countries. But I think the visit to the Central African Republic will be the most critical. It's probably one of the many volatile places in Africa because of political, tribal, ethnic unrest. Part of it, of course, is the fault of Christian militias, and I think the Pope will have firm words for them. I think from what he said already in his first address to the diplomatic corps and to the government authorities in Kenya, he's speaking about the significance of working harmoniously in countries where there are different ethnic, social and political interests. He spoke about the foundations of mutual respect, of dialogue, cooperation. We have the reality of multi-ethnic societies, but he wants a society that's truly, as he says, harmonious, just and inclusive. So I think he's picked countries where there is sufficient stability for him with reasonable safety to visit.
Reverend Lucas, of course, as you know, two of those three countries, along with some others that he's not visiting this time, have a real sectarian divide between Christians and Muslims. I understand one of the objectives he hopes is to bridge that divide.
Well, we've certainly found, and I'm sure this is the recent experience in the United States as it is in Australia, following the terrible business that occurred in Paris, our societies are shaping up along that divide. There are countries in Africa, of course, where there are very long-standing, clear divisions between Christian communities and Muslim communities. They are separate. The Pope will say that it is absolutely necessary through dialogue and through compromise and through mutual respect to find the way of harmonious coexistence rather than to try to find those solutions through violence.
On his first day in Kenya on Wednesday, he urged authorities there to tackle poverty and corruption. He said, quote, "I encourage you to work with integrity and transparency for the common good and to foster a spirit of solidarity at every level of society."
It was interesting, after that particular quote that you made, he went on to say something which was, I think, very significant about showing a genuine concern for the needs of the poor, but also, as well as the just aspirations of young people, to a just distribution of natural and human resources. And, of course, corruption is fundamentally associated with greed, where individuals seek to enrich themselves at the expense of others, which, of course, is the exact opposite of what he's talking about with a just distribution of natural and human resources.
That's Brian Lucas of the Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference. On Friday, the Pope visits Nairobi slum before moving on to Uganda and a shrine for Christian martyrs, as well as a trip to a mosque and refugee camp in the CAR, which has been gripped by sectarian violence since a Muslim takeover of the government of the mostly Christian nation in 2013. Well, as we noted earlier in the show, the holiday season is once again upon us. That means retailers and shopping malls around the world are busy with the final decorating touches for the start of the all-important holiday shopping season. Here in the United States, that's usually the Friday after the Thanksgiving holiday. Retailers call the start of the holiday shopping season Black Friday. That's because for many retailers, it marks the day they finally move from the red, as in losses, into the black, as in profits. Mill Arcega has more.
It's the most profitable time of the year for retailers, accounting for 20 to 30% of annual revenue. And this year, close to 150 million U.S. citizens will go shopping over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend, says Kathy Granis Allen with the National Retail Federation.
So this is our Super Bowl, and this really is the one time a year that the gloves are off and the competition just heightens.
To compete, some stores will open early and stay open longer. Nearly all promise big savings to attract the maximum number of shoppers. But this year, some retailers, including Nordstrom, Costco, and others, will stay closed Thanksgiving, while outdoor wear retailer REI stays closed on Black Friday as well. While their profits could take a hit, business author Kevin Paul Scott tells us on Skype the message is about tradition and family values.
And people remember that. And beyond the holidays, when they're buying Mother's Day and Father's Day gifts next May and June, they will remember these retailers. They'll spend more money there, and those retailers win in the long run.
But more people are opting to avoid the crowds. This year, the NRF says more than half of all holiday purchases will be made online, with one in five Americans using a tablet or smartphone. That's the highest since the NRF started asking the question in 2011.
And we do think that digital is going to continue to drive the conversation in retail more and more every year.
The most interesting part is not how much they spend, although that's important, but where they're spending it. And we're going to see the online shopping really, I think, put a dent in a lot of traditional brick and mortar stores this year.
Despite tepid sales last month, lower unemployment and rising wages could give Americans more disposable income this year, says economist Gus Fauché on Skype.
They're benefiting from lower gasoline prices as well. That gives them more money to spend on other things, lower home heating costs, so that's good news. And we're just adding a lot of jobs, seeing stronger wage gains. I think that people are going to be in the mood to spend.
According to the NRF, the average American consumer will spend about $805 on gifts. That's more than $630 billion between November and December, an increase of 3.7% from last year. Mill Arcega, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Choreographer and dancer Twyla Tharp is an American icon. Well, for her golden anniversary this year, Tharp's been taking a pair of new works on a 17-city tour. Bill Zeebel reports from Dallas, Texas, where the tour began.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown.
In April of 1965, Twyla Tharp, with two colleagues, danced her first work using Petula Clark's popular song, Downtown.
Just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose?
She told the Dallas audience that 10 Tank Dive premiered in New York's Hunter College and lasted all of about 4.5 minutes.
Because I figured that's all I knew about a beginning and a middle and an end, and I could get it into that period of time. So if you were late, you kind of missed the whole thing. But that was okay, because I think 14 people came. And that's okay, too.
Because she knew that she could do it. She's since created hundreds of dances over 5 decades, presenting them on the dance stage, Broadway theaters, for television and film. On this anniversary tour, she presents not one, but 2 premieres. Tharp is 74. She does not believe in slowing down.
The point of work is, to me, doing more work. There's always time for the past, and I value the past. Not only my past, but others' past. But the future's got lots of room for the past. The present has only now.
And for now, Tharp says it's time for the world as it ought to be, and for the world as it is. At least according to her. To Bach's well-tempered clavier, Tharp pays tribute to dance giants she learned from: Merce Cunningham, Martha Graham, Jerome Robbins, George Balanchine. Tharp's first work, Preludes and Fugues, presents a world of equality, justice, balance.
People have an overview of tolerance, and that diversity does not separate. It is possible to congregate as a diverse lot. That would be the world as it ought to be. The world as it is had best be approached with humor.
And so the other work, Yowzy, is danced to jazz, with funny interactions between couples and slapstick moves inspired by Tharp's beloved silent film comedies. As she helped pioneer the use of pop, rock, and jazz in serious dance, Tharp also blended modern and classical ballet moves in her work. That used to shock the dance world, but no more. Dancer John Celia, who matured with the Classical American Ballet Theater, joined Tharp 16 years ago.
I love being a ballet dancer, but sometimes I disagree with how marginalized it is. People have a certain idea of it, and if it goes out of the boundaries, they reject it.
Celia embraced it, welcoming the challenge of dancing in Tharp's company and learning to be more creative than he'd been allowed at ABT. Combining dance styles and musical genres opened up the art form, says Lily Weiss. The longtime professional dancer is the artistic director at Dallas' Booker T. Washington High School. It's consistently among the nation's best art schools.
That Look by Bill Zeeble at the career of Twyla Tharp. And this is today's show. Thanks for listening. I'm Sarah Williams, and please have a very happy Thanksgiving.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
The first Thursday in November is a national day of Thanksgiving in the United States. The tradition is a very old one, dating to the arrival of the first English settlers in North America in the 17th century, who, after their first successful harvest, paused to celebrate their bounty and give thanks for surviving their first terrible winter in what was then a wilderness. Falling in the autumn, Thanksgiving has much in common with harvest holidays in other nations and cultures, such as Vietnam's Chung Tu celebration and Hamoo, the annual yam festival in Ghana. Still, with its turkey dinners, family gatherings, football games, and parades, there's something about the day that is distinctively American. Together with July 4th, when the United States marks its independence from Great Britain, it's a truly national holiday that includes all citizens in a common purpose, regardless of religious, political, or ethnic persuasion. It is also a time for people to look back at the year, take stock, and think about the future. With our nation dealing with crises in Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and West Africa, the looming uncertainties likely will be on many minds today. President Abraham Lincoln proclaimed the first official Thanksgiving amid similar serious circumstances, the American Civil War. But like their colonial ancestors, Americans are essentially an optimistic people. Surrounded by friends and family, today as in the past, they will enter into the spirit of the day, giving thanks for life's blessings and the promise of the future, living in a free land.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage
at www.voanews.com/editorials.